yesterday, we talked about P+IP superconductivity, and we saw that this could be a host for realizing Majorana fermions. I can't think of an example of a proposal to realize Majorana fermions which does not involve a P+IP superconductor, either as an analogy or as a superconductor. You might wonder whether P-wave superconductivity exists in just as superconductivity without an analogy with the quantum Hall effect or what I'm going to show you today. And actually, there is a material called strontium ruthenate that is believed to be a chiral P-wave superconductor. It is probably a P-wave superconductor. Whether it's really PX+IPY is kind of controversial. I put in the notes a reference to a paper by Kalin and Berlinski that basically survey the evidence of whether we do have a chiral P-wave superconductivity. The main evidence would basically come from broken time reversal symmetry. Since it's chiral, it will have chiral edge modes. Time reversal is spontaneously broken here. And as I mentioned in the fractional quantum Hall effect, the nu equals 5/2 is also believed to be analogous to P+IP superconductor. And many proposals on how to realize Majorana fermions in that state exist, and also how to manipulate them. But today I'm going to talk about how to use a three-dimensional topological insulator and produce a P+IP superconductor once you put it in proximity with, on one side, a ferromagnet, and on the other side, a superconductor, a regular S-wave superconductor. So first, I just want to say a few words about 3D topological insulators. So we didn't cover that at all. So 3D topological insulators are basically characterized by something like the Chern number, but it actually is a vector of four components in three. So each one of them can be 0, 1. When we did a 2D version of it, we basically had one Chern number that could have been odd or even, or basically 0, 1, because all of the odd numbers are the same, all of the even numbers are the same. And another name for the 2D topological insulator would be a Z2 topological insulator. However, in three dimensions, there's more richness. You can see that if any of these numbers could be either 0 or 1, we have 16 different classes of topological insulators classified by this. And people are actually working hard on rewriting the periodic table for topological insulators, basically looking at topological properties, various symmetries, inversion symmetry, time reversal symmetry, and so on. But roughly, there are these 16 classes. Of these topological number, nu naught is important, because when nu naught is 0 or 1, there's a different behavior. When it is 0, we call it a weak topological insulator. And when it is 1, we call it a strong topological insulator. And we're mainly interested in the strong topological insulator. So a weak topological insulator would be a state that is basically like a collection of 2D topological insulators. It's less robust. Its edge modes are not on all edges. That all depends on orientation. That basically comes from this three-dimensional vector. And the edge modes are not robust. They might scatter into each other, and we're left with just a regular insulator. However, a strong topological insulator is truly 3D. So you can think of it We said that the Iraq points come in pairs. That's true. And in a 3D topological insulator, you can think of it as just a collection of Dirac points, but in three dimensions. And the Dirac points could be massive, and the mass is coming from spin orbit coupling. So we have an even number of Dirac points, but if we have an odd number of pairs, that would be a strong topological insulator in 3D, because on the surface, you basically realize half of the pairs. So from each pair, when you have surfaces, you realize one Dirac cone on one surface and the other Dirac point on the other surface. And basically, you get a Dirac-like system on the surface, which has an odd number of Dirac points. Now, that is forbidden in a system. So we saw with graphene, for example, we have two Dirac points. But if the system is just an edge of a 3D system, then we can violate this theorem that the Dirac points have to come in pairs. Yes. Yeah, so. You can always deform. I mean, when you have, so the way we're going to picture our 3D topological insulator is just think of two Dirac points somewhere inside the system. And then you can always cut it into, let's say, a box, right? And then if you want to make an odd shape, as long as you don't change the topology, all of the properties will continue. So you can, if you can smoothly deform the shape you're thinking about to just my regular, let's say a cubic sample, then you're fine. So the question is, are you going to change the topology or not? So if you're not, then you can just carry out everything we do.
Yeah. What happens if you decide to drill a hole in our sample?
That's a good question. I don't know. I really don't know, and I think it depends what the wave functions do around that hole. But it's like you're creating another edge, basically. Yeah, that's a good question. Okay. So let's just go on and try to describe the surface of a topological insulator. And what I have is a model that stems from something like a strong topological insulator that comes from something like a semiconductor with strong spin orbit coupling. And what you get, and we'll just take that as a given, so I have whatever chemical potential I want. And this is a spin orbit coupling term that you might recall is the Rashba term that we discussed in the context of graphene, of the Kane-Miller model. So note that here, the Rashba term is actually what enables the topological insulator. In graphene, the Rashba term was ruining the topological insulator. But in graphene, we had a different degree of freedom. We had a pseudo spin, the A and B sublattice. Here, we only have a spin. So what does this model look like? If you think about this term only, this is just a Dirac, massless Dirac model, because before we had K dot sigma, so we had around the Dirac point, we had our spin basically pointing parallel to the momentum. Here, it's just K cross sigma. So basically, we have the spins in the plane pointing perpendicular to the momentum. So we basically have a situation like that. But it's still a Dirac point. You know, if you it's just the roles of kx and ky are different. But if you calculate the Berry phase, you'll still get a non-trivial Berry phase as you go around this point this way or this way. Still the same. And we have another term here, which is like a k squared term and a chemical potential. For the surface of a strong topological insulator in 3D. So this is two-dimensional, okay?
Where does that term with the sigmas and the derivatives come from?
Where does that come from? So this is Rashba's spinor decoupling. Okay? So it just comes from the properties of the material. And when we take usually heavy elements, we have strong spinor decoupling. And let us just imagine now that we have this, that this is the dominant term. So you can think that, just a second, that when your momentum is small, then this is linear in momentum, this is quadratic in momentum, then this might be the dominant term. So I have something like a Dirac point. Yes?
Yeah. What happens to the system if we apply a B field, a magnetic field to it? Because we don't usually apply a magnetic field in the topological insulator.
Yeah, so we will, there's actually been some work. People looked at, can you get a quantum Hall effect and all of that. Quantum Hall effect in general and in a Dirac system is a little different than in a parabolic system. You basically get uneven spacing between levels. But we're going to actually not really add a magnetic field here, but we're going to add a Zeeman field, something that just splits up and down. In a second, we'll do that. But basically, if you think about that, if we have a Dirac point and we add something that's quadratic in momentum, we're just going to change a little bit at higher energy. We might change the dispersion. Yeah, I guess like that sort of, and like that. But still at low energy, or at low K, we're going to have our Dirac point. So as long as really the significant area is governed by this, we get a Dirac point. And now I want to give you a picture of the device that we're envisioning. So we're going to have a simple S-wave superconductor here, which we'll get to later. We have this topological insulator, which we can imagine that we have maybe a thin layer, so we everything that happens in the surface is going to dominate, and the bulk is gapped in any case. But we don't want it to be thin enough, because we don't want the two edges to talk to each other. And we're going to have here a ferromagnet. And the effect of the main effect of the ferromagnet is to add a Zeeman field, something that prefers spin up to spin down. You can think of it as just having some magnetic moments here that create some out-of-plane magnetic field. They also there's also some spin orbit effect that is induced by the ferromagnet, but it's weaker and we're going to neglect it. So what I want to add is another piece to the Hamiltonian now, and I'm imagining that on this surface I still feel the ferromagnetic Zeeman splitting, so I have Hz, which is just okay, so I just added something that looks like a mass. So we started with maybe a little bit distorted Dirac point. Now we added a mass to it. This Vz acts like a mass in the Dirac. Yeah. We can talk about any of the boundaries, but it's easy to think about one of them. So let's think about this boundary. But I want to say that the ferromagnet induces also Zeeman splitting in this boundary. And now, so we opened a gap. How big is this gap? Coming from this term. So this is, if this is k, this is going to be k equals 0. Okay? So how big is this? Let's write everything in momentum space, okay? So h, k. So I'm going to have just psi k. HK, psi k. So HK now is a matrix which looks like k squared over 2m. I'm neglecting h bars minus mu, k squared over 2m minus mu. And then I have k y, k y minus I k x. Put a plus and ky minus I kx. Okay? And now I added this Zeeman term, so I have plus bz and minus bz. So this is what it looks like in momentum space. Okay? So now I opened a gap. So if you look at this spectrum, it looks like a shifted Dirac spectrum. And we open the gap, and the gap is usually twice the mass. So this gap is 2vz. So this is going to be vz. This is our shifted energy zero. So we have an overall shift, k squared over 2m minus mu. And we have this vz. And now at low energies, at small k's, let's just think of the shift mu. So mu is going to shift our zero effectively. So either up or down. So let's say this is mu. And I want to focus on a region where mu is less than vz. And the reason I want to do that is that I want to stay within the gap. I want to still be in a situation where mostly the lower band is full and the upper band is empty. Okay? And now let's solve this. So this is quite simple to solve. I know already what is the dispersion. Okay, so can you tell me the dispersion? We have a constant shift, so that's just adding. So what do I add?
This is the universal coefficient alpha.
Thank you. Yeah, there's an alpha. Okay. So there's a constant shift here, k squared over 2m minus mu. And after I subtracted the unit matrix times this term from my Hamiltonian, now I can diagonalize. Now it just looks like vz sigma z plus alpha ky sigma x plus kx sigma y. And you know that that you're going to get, when you solve it, you're just going to get an energy that is plus or minus vz squared plus alpha squared k squared. Okay? And the reason I know that is because we've seen different 2x2 matrices, but they all have the same spectrum. If you have a mass, it's going to come here, and if you have Dirac-like, it's going to come here. Okay? So this is just a massive Dirac. And I want to diagonalize it and look at the two states. So basically, when we have no spin orbit coupling, we're going to have an up band and a down band. Here, when we add the spin orbit coupling, the up and down are going to mix. And basically, what we're going to have is a spectrum where The spin is not well defined, so this is a mixture of up and down, and this is a mixture of up and down. And let's call that the plus band and that the minus band. Yes. Yeah. So this is the surface of the 3D. Yeah, so everything is two-dimensional on the surface. Yeah. So now let's just solve that. I know for me it's easier to solve it thinking of superconductivity because I just happen to remember that the coherence factors look like u squared is half of 1 plus psi k over ek, where psi is the kinetic energy, so this would be replaced. This is the mass term, basically. And vk is just 1 minus uk, so it's 1 minus psi k over ek. And there's also a phase that is usually the phase of the order parameter. So here in our case, this is like psi k, and this is like our complex order parameter. Okay? So therefore, I have two bands. So let's write the wave function for the upper and lower bands. So I want to call that A up, A down, and I want to put the phase here, so I have to put here e to the minus I phi, which means that I'm going to take ky minus I kx over k. And for the minus band, it doesn't matter where I put the phase, I can put the opposite phase here, right? So for the minus band, I just get b up, b down, which are just the amplitudes of these u's. But I want to put a phase here, ky plus I kx over k. So this is just for convenience. I put it here and not there. It doesn't matter. And you notice that, so here actually ek is the absolute value. If I had a negative ek, I have to flip the signs here to write it with the absolute value again. So this tells me already what A up and A down, and B up and B down are. So A up is 1 over root 2 square root of 1 plus, and now this psi k is going to be vc because it's whatever stands in front of the sigma z, over the dispersion of the Dirac, so the non-shifted dispersion is just the square root of vz squared plus alpha squared k squared. So is this clear how I got this? You basically have to just diagonalize this matrix. All I'm doing, yeah.
What's 5 plus and 5 minus?
These are the eigenvectors of this matrix. So basically, I want to transform my Hamiltonian and take my psi up and psi down, okay, to be A up I plus and plus B up I minus and A down I plus B down I minus, and I have phases here that I didn't insert, so let's say B times the phase, some phase that I didn't write, maybe phase that I didn't write. Okay, so I'm just diagonalizing. I'm rewriting psi up and down as a combination of two bands. But if I really wrote the Hamiltonian in these two bands, I'm going to have H be
let's say, 5 plus side plus dagger plus dagger side plus with some E plus epsilon plus epsilon minus pi minus well actually yeah this is included already minus dagger. Okay, so I'm just diagonalizing the Hamiltonian. So I rewrite my operators in a way that this matrix is diagonal. Yeah, so that's all I want to do. Okay, but the way I do it is just by analogy to BCS theory or to Dirac equation, whatever you can remember fast. I remember the coherence factors and superconductivity, so I just borrow them and translate them to these coefficients. The same thing, it's just that here psi k is played by Vz, and Ek is the dispersion, is the part of the dispersion that is not shifted. Okay? So I just look at this as some constant term or a term times a unit matrix plus a Dirac kind of Hamiltonian. So I know how to diagonalize. You can just work it out, but I do it faster when I look at the analogy. And I have another one, which is 1 minus Vz over Vz squared plus epsilon squared k squared. So this is what you get when you have the energy of the plus sign. So this is our energy, so let's call it epsilon. So this is going to be epsilon plus. Okay? And it's all k dependent, but since everything is translational invariant, I can work with a single k, and same treatment works for every k. And I can do the same for the lower band. And the difference I get is just the sign here in front. That is different. So now these coefficients are real. And the phases are, I already pulled them out here. These will be the phases, and I have this, and I just want to write on the side what is important for us from this is actually some functions that are a combination. So you can convince yourself, I'm giving it a name FP that will be obvious shortly. So A up times A down is equal to B up times B down. And it is square root, so this times this, basically. So I have a half in front. And then I have 1 minus Vz squared and Vz squared plus alpha squared k squared. Okay? And this is equal to k over Vz squared plus alpha squared k squared. Okay? I just multiplied the two under the root. I got 1 minus this squared, and then when I write this one as v squared plus k squared, the v squared drops, and I just get the k on top, and the denominator stays. And then fs is going to be a up, b down, minus b up, a down, and
this is going to be. So you can see that A up and B down are actually the same. So it's just the square of this. And I take the square of this minus the square of that. So I get half of there's a half here. Still. Right. And an alpha. That's right. So half of 1 minus VZ over the square root minus 1 plus VZ over the square root. So I get, in the end, minus 2 VZ over the square root. VZ squared plus alpha squared K squared. So I get minus VZ over square root of VZ squared plus alpha squared K squared. And the reason we define these functions is that they appear as we are going to diagonalize another bit of the Hamiltonian. So all I did so far was just rewrite the Hamiltonian with new operators, which are defined by the wave functions that diagonalize this Hamiltonian. So I basically told you, if you want to look at an eigenstate, these are the amplitudes of your vector in the old basis, and the Hamiltonian is diagonal in the new basis. So not much. But now I want to add superconductivity. And let me say a word about this. So far, we talked about what happens to this edge without a superconductor when we just add the Zeeman splitting to it. Okay? But now I want to add a superconductor. And in general, whenever you have any kind of metal or any Fermi liquid, and here we could, we have basically an insulator, but you can think of almost any order parameter, and in this case, superconductor order parameter. So let's say on one side we have a non-zero, and now I'm just going, let's say, in the direction perpendicular to the surface. So if I start from the top, then I have a non-zero order parameter, and I'm thinking of a regular S-wave order parameter. And here, very far from the surface, you should have a zero. Well, it turns out that it just doesn't drop to zero immediately. It just slowly decays. And this is called proximity effect. One way to understand it is the following. Two materials or any condensed matter system that has itinerant electron can reduce its energy by hopping. Okay, that's what we always do on a lattice. But to hop into the superconductor is not possible because there are no single particle states in the superconductor. But what we do have are pairs. So basically, if electrons in the normal side, so this is a superconductor and this is a normal side, if electrons in the normal side decide to pair up and jump into the superconductor, they can reduce the energy that way because they can just go into the condensate. And this basically induces an effective pairing order parameter in the normal side. And this is what we want to take into account now. So I'm just assuming that by putting an S-wave superconductor here, I'm inducing a pairing term. So the term that I induce is basically an S-wave. So H of S-wave superconductor is just going to be independent of K. Or the function is independent of K, so I have delta. And then I'm going to have psi dagger up, psi dagger down. or I can write it in real space also, but it doesn't matter. The main thing is that I'm just pairing up and down in Hermitian conjugate, and I have no special dependence of delta in the momentum. So we're just pairing up and down. And now I want to ask the question, what will happen if we do that in our situation of the, when the bands are given by these functions? So I just want to rewrite this up and down, these up and down states, I just want to rewrite them in terms of A and B. And I get the following. So I want to write psi up dagger here. So I have to take A up. So I have A up, and let's call it phi plus. Okay. And I want to put daggers here. Plus B up. And B up comes with, I erased it, but it comes with a phase ky plus ikx over k, and I need to take the complex conjugate. And I have phi minus dagger. And I multiply by psi down, which would be given by A down, psi plus dagger. And this had a phase also, so this had a ky plus ikx over k, plus b down psi minus dagger. So all I'm doing here is I'm rewriting the superconducting term in terms of the new, in the new basis. And what I get is the following. So, and I have the emission conjugate, of course. What I get is the following. I get terms that look like delta naught, A up, A down, phi plus, dagger phi plus. So this is an intraband pairing. I also get B up, B down, up to maybe signs that I forgot. And I forgot an important phase factor that there is here, which is ky plus ikx over k. And I also have it for the minus. And here I'll have ky minus ikx over k. And I have delta naught b up a down minus b down a up. And here the phases actually cancel. When I multiply this term by this term, this phase cancels. And I just get nothing, basically. And that's it. And I have just phi plus dagger, minus dagger. Okay, and I get a minus sign because in the other term I had phi minus phi plus, so I just commute them and get a minus sign. So what we got is our initial Hamiltonian psi naught, plus all of these pairing terms on top here. So our initial Hamiltonian was just diagonal, and now we have something that isn't diagonal. In principle, what we have to do is rediagonalize, right? It doesn't matter which basis we chose, but we need to rediagonalize and find the new eigenmodes. However, I'm going to make a shortcut here. Because I'm interested in a situation where delta is small. So we had before we introduced delta, we had the two bands. We had, this was our VZ, and our mu was somewhere here maybe, smaller than VZ. Now, we still have a pretty large gap, which is VZ minus mu on this side, or VZ plus mu on this side. Okay? So I want to take a delta such that it's much smaller than VZ minus mu. So why do you think I want to take this limit? So I told you before, we took a small mu because I wanted this full band to stay full and this band to be empty. Okay? So basically, I want this to still be the case. Even though I'm adding superconductivity, I don't want superconductivity to mix these bands very much. And if you do the calculation, if you take a really small beta, delta, and you diagonalize the full Hamiltonian, you'll find that there's very small probability still that your electrons in the ground state actually come from the upper band. Most of them are going to come from the lower band. So I'm just going to do a little shortcut and instead just assume that I can project my Hamiltonian onto the lower band. So projecting the Hamiltonian means that I'm only going to look at states that are relevant. So I'm just going to forget about all of the psi pluses. So I'm just going to take in my Hamiltonian, my projection. So a projection operator is going to be something like that, phi minus, phi minus. Okay? So I'm forgetting about psi plus. And therefore, the full Hamiltonian, the projected Hamiltonian that I get looks like the following. I have epsilon k minus, because I only took the lower band, so psi k dagger psi k, plus delta naught, and I only have the b up, b down, which we call that FP. So I have some FP here, which does not have dependence on the direction of k. This is just the magnitude of k, times kx, ky minus ikx over k, and now phi k dagger phi k daggers. And these are all minus. Okay, so this is all in the minus band. So now you see that basically I got three channels of superconductivity. One was an S-wave-like channel. There is no dependence here on K. And if you look at this function, there's also no dependent on the direction of K. So it's not uniform over K, but it's uniform around K. So we call that S-wave, meaning that it has rotational symmetry with K. And we have two other channels, which are intraband, which have this factor. This is like a PX plus IPY, basically. Because they have a directional dependence. They are complex. And there are in the two bands. And now that we've specified that we want to be in the lower band, we basically picked out this one. Yes.
They are
ky
minus ikx. Yeah.
Yeah.
This might look like
now. Y to you? Okay. Yeah, it's ky minus ikx. Okay, and if you pull an I multiply by I, it's kx plus iky. So basically, what we got is a P wave superconductor. Even though we started with an S-wave superconductor. So effectively, this is a P-wave superconductor, which has no spin, okay? It looks like it has no spin. Because instead of a spin now, since the two spin states are mixed, instead of spin, we have our plus and minus bands, okay? We started with two spins, we added spin orbit coupling, we mixed them, so we have one mixture giving us the minus band, the other mixture giving us the plus band, and we took only the minus minus, so it looks like there's no spin dependence. It's actually hidden here somewhere, there is spin dependence. And it just has the P wave symmetry. Now, the one thing that is kind of different than the usual case is epsilon k, which is usually just this term, but basically this term is even stronger, so we have a different dispersion here. Minus mu minus vz squared plus epsilon k squared. So this is the dispersion. But basically, it still gives rise to Majorana modes in the same way. And you can maybe do that by smoothly deforming this dispersion to the regular dispersion. And we really only care about the electrons at the low energy. Okay, so that is when delta is negligible. You can imagine, though, that delta might not be negligible. And we really have to consider the whole Hamiltonian. However, if the Majorana state is guaranteed by the topology, then if we smoothly change delta, and there's no reason why we cannot change delta smoothly in terms of parameters, we would expect that there's a range of deltas in which we still have a Majorana mode. So, and this in itself, the existence of Majorana is stronger than just this analogy to a P wave superconductor. And actually, the early work of proposing this kind of realization of P plus IP superconductor with Fu and Kane, they basically didn't take the limit and they just considered whether there is a Majorana mode in a vortex core. So you have to also create a vortex. But they found a Majorana. The bulk is gonna, you basically have two Majoranas, one on each surface. Now the challenge would be whether you can manipulate them in a separate way. There has been a proposal to sort of build a device that will have a plane of the topological insulator and put on there some S waves like that, and basically get a channel for the Majorana modes. So there are different things that one can do with that, but it's still not the end of the work. There is still a challenge to actually realize that, and not just realizing a Majorana mode. What we want to do at the end of the day is be able to move them around and even wind them around each other. If we don't have enough control to do that, then we can't say that we realize the Majorana mode.
Does this setup give you anything like a Josephson term?
This one?
Does the setup give you anything like a Josephson term?
I don't think so. I think of Josephson current as tunneling of pairs of electrons, and here I'm thinking of a Majorana mode. You might also trap some Josephson current, but I imagine it would be perpendicular to this direction. And maybe there is some interplay between having the Majoranas move in one direction and the Josephson current move in another direction. But that is possible, but I haven't thought about that. Okay. So I think we're done, actually, with what I wanted to say about Majorana modes today. Maybe let me just remind you what we did in the past 3 weeks. So basically, I chose to present graphene first, even though chronologically the quantum Hall effect was first updated. It basically emerged in the 80s, and people, some people, not everybody, but some people got fed up with it and left it aside for some time. But it is now, there's some revived interest because of the topological insulators. And the topological insulators business was all inspired by graphene. So graphene, I chose to present it first just because it's the simplest of all of these phenomena. But nevertheless, it was quite interesting from a theoretical point of view and from an experimental point of view, because it's the first time that we realized A, truly two-dimensional material, and B, Dirac points. So there are Dirac points also in other materials, but in superconductivity and D-wave superconductivity, it's a different business because all of the excitations on the Dirac cone don't have a well-defined charge. But in graphene, we have just good quasi-particles which have the Dirac modes. And then after we discussed some of the properties of graphene, we went on to talk about the quantum Hall effect. We learned about how to get the integer quantum Hall effect, the fractional quantum Hall effect in a sketchy way. We learned about varied phases that basically are the common theme of many systems and should not be ignored as a lesson from the quantum Hall effect. And then we reached a peculiar phase, which is a topological insulator, which has non-trivial varied phases in it, even though we did not apply any magnetic field and not broken time reversal symmetry. And the amazing thing about it is that it all comes from a single particle physics. We have spin orbit coupling, but it's not coupling between electrons. It just adds to the single particle physics and mixes up the spins. But still, in the end of the day, we have quadratic Hamiltonians, which we can just diagonalize. And basically, that's what we've done in the past week, is just diagonalize 2x2 matrices, or sometimes 4x4. So if anyone has any questions about anything today or other days, very welcome.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about the time reversal symmetry in topological insulators. I don't really understand the concept of time reversal symmetries.
So time reversal symmetry is basically taking all of your momenta and angular momenta and reversing its sign. Okay, so if you have k, it goes to minus k. If you have spin, it will go to the opposite spin. If you have angular momentum, you're going to go to the opposite angular momentum. Usually, it's a symmetry that we respect very much. So many, many symmetries that you can look at a Hamiltonian and you say it's symmetric, there could be perturbations that will break that symmetry. Time reversal symmetry is not often broken, but as we saw, it sometimes is broken. So for example, on the surface of a 2D of a 3D topological insulators, on the edges of a 2D topological insulators. The quantum Hall state is a little different because we already, by applying magnetic field, we've broken the time reversal symmetry. P plus IP superconductivity also breaks time reversal symmetry just by definition. It has a direction. Yeah.
Main open problems in topological insulators.
Okay. So this is a narrow view, and everything I gave in this course is a narrow view because it's my view. I think there are interesting problems starting from Majorana fermions. Can you really realize? And I think there's still a lot of work. I think there's a lot of work looking at not the clean and non-interacting limit of topological insulators. Not clean and not the non-interacting, but the interacting. So once you add impurities, for example, and I think this is fascinating, when you look at topological insulators, we know experimentally, basically, and even more than that, that we need two ingredients. One is crossing off bands, and the other is opening up a gap due to spin-orbit coupling. And then we want to be in the gap. We want to fill one band and leave the other band empty. And actually, some of the experiments, the main part is to get to the Fermi level to that gap. But basically, it turns out that you might not have to do that, that you can be in a system that has that inversion symmetry and not open any gap due to spin-orbit coupling or have a weak spin-orbit coupling. And if the system is dirty enough, what you open up is a mobility gap. So you have states in the gap, but they're all localized by the impurities. And only if you go to higher energies, you actually have continuous bands. And it turns out that you can have a topological insulator where the gap is not a real gap, it's a mobility gap. So I think the role of disorder in these systems is still underexplored, and there's a lot to do. Another thing which I'm myself interested in is we have an analog of the integer quantum Hall effect in topological insulators. Basically, the Chern numbers that we discussed for the 2D topological insulators are 0 or 1. And we don't have 2, 3, 4, just because we have two bands. But we also don't know what happens at partial filling. And we know that from the quantum Hall effect, if you have partial filling, if you add interactions, you might open a mini gap somewhere and get into a fractional state. So I just wonder whether you can do the same with a topological insulator. Can I take a band model, partially fill it, add interactions, that interactions usually open a gap in the Fermi level. So can I do that and get into some exotic state that will have a fractional Chern number? And therefore, you know, fractional charges and fractional statistics and all that. So in preliminary results seem to suggest that, yeah, you might be able to do that in certain circumstances in a topological, 2D topological insulator. But it's kind of a difficult problem to approach because we don't really know what the wave functions might look like. So it's hard to do a variational study. Okay, any more? Okay.
Okay, so Tammy, thank you very much for giving this wonderful course, and that's a thank you for the gift. You are one of our 2011 perimeter PSI t-shirts. Okay.
Is that the perimeter logo?
No, that's our logo.
And something that's
oh, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And if you guys feel like staying in touch, you can find me on Facebook, or send me an email, and let me know what's going on with you.
Yes, and of course, Tammy's moving to Canada over the summer, so she'll be back in the country.
Okay, my friends, after lunch, we're going to turn the tutorial. There we go, last one. So we're going to do this brief study.